Let us barge ahead. We had some good, strong learning this morning on various parts of the Holy Rule, and we're going to continue with that this afternoon, more or less picking up where we left off in chapter 2, the chapter on the abbot. We got as far as verse 15, and just for the sake of saving a little bit of time, we're not going to get through the whole rule, as you've noticed by now. We can read verse 16 quickly. The abbot should avoid all favoritism in the monastery. That's kind of common sense, isn't it? And you can read the rest of that paragraph, which gives a theological foundation for that. But after that, so we skip that paragraph and go on and begin our teaching this afternoon in earnest at verse 23, still talking about the role of the abbot. I would just remind you that the reading of this chapter is a fundamental insight into Cenobitic monasticism. A Cenobite is described as a monk who lives under a rule and an abbot. And so that's why Benedict begins this part of the rule by a long statement about what the abbot is. And personally speaking, this is an occasion for me to share with you my own experience of having become the abbot, to what I called in my letter to you my immense astonishment. But also, hopefully, the reading of this chapter together not only gives you an insight into the life, but makes you feel sorry for me and pray for me. I really appreciate Diana's formulation last night, to know how to pray for me. And I really covet your prayers so that I can become the kind of abbot that Benedict sets as his ideal. In verse 23, he says, in his teaching, the abbot should always observe the apostle's recommendation, in which he says, use argument, appeal, and reproof. Once again, St. Benedict is developing his argument by citing scripture and by making everything that happens in the monastery have its scriptural authority and its scriptural warrant. Often in any ancient text, when the scriptures are cited, the method is to cite one verse, and the careful reader is to know or come to know the whole context. And so the whole context of this, from the passage is 2 Timothy 4:2, but the fuller context would be this text of St. Paul's, proclaim the message, press it home on all occasions, in season or out of season. Use argument, reproof, and appeal. That's the whole text. Press it home on all occasions. And it finishes after that with all the patience that the work of teaching requires. So that full advice of the Apostle Paul, Benedict wants to apply to the abbot. And then in what follows, a very nice development of what that means. He says, this means that the abbot must vary with circumstances, threatening and coaxing by turns. And a whole bunch of verbs here come out that have to are new skills that I need to develop. I don't know that I've ever threatened anyone. Not the type, you know. So this is why it's a stretch for me. But if, you know, sometimes the circumstances require that. Threatening and coaxing by turns. Stern as a taskmaster. Devoted and tender as only a father can be. So that, to me, that's a great sentence, and a lot of wisdom is required to know when to do that. You can most certainly pray for me that I could pull that off. With the undisciplined and restless, there are such, huh? With the undisciplined and restless, he will use firm argument. Notice here that he's picking up the three words again, argument, appeal, and reproof. And he's saying what each one is. The first one he picks up is argument. You use argument with the undisciplined and the restless. With the obedient and docile and patient, there are also those. In fact, there are more of those. There are a lot of good monks. Huh? The abbot has to attend to the, not just to the problems, but to the good monks. And with those, he would appeal for greater virtue. But as for the negligent and disdainful, we charge him to use reproof and rebuke. This is a very strong formulation. And I think in my own case as abbot, the brief time I've been abbot, I'm reluctant to act that way. It's hard to do that. And that Benedict lays it on me as a charge is, I certainly experience it as a burden. I think my predecessors did too, because there's people that should have been rebuked years ago and haven't been. So, this is the problem, huh? You know. Ideally, these things are really dealt with in a forthright way, and that would certainly be a way in which you could be praying for me and helping me with your support. He develops this. He should not gloss over the sins of those who err, but cut them out while he can, as soon as they begin to sprout. And here's the biblical warrant for that. Remembering the fate of Eli, the priest of Shiloh. So you have to know that story. The biblical reference there is two chapters of the Bible. And it's a very strong story. The monks would have known that. That's when Eli had those two godless sons that would go up to the sacrifices, you know, where the animals were roasting for the gods, and they'd steal the meat for themselves and have a feast, you know. It was a sacrilege, and Eli was told to reprimand them and didn't, and the whole house of Eli and all his descendants were destroyed. So Eli and his sons destroyed. The abbot and his sons destroyed. It's a possibility. Yeah, it's so Benedict expects us to feel the force of the biblical images. For upright and perceptive men, his first and second warnings should be verbal. But for those who are evil or stubborn, arrogant or disobedient, he can curb only by blows or by some other physical punishment at the first offense. Well, there you have it. It was a different world. It's, you know, we don't do that. But this tells us something about monasticism centuries ago. It tells us something about, interesting, what people were willing to submit to. In a sense, you come and you're a monk, and then you turn into a bad monk, and the abbot hits you, and you stay anyway. So what kind of a world is that? This is interesting, you know? And that's a world where, among other things, people did take their vows quite seriously. And they stayed in it. And, you know, we have a different and probably a more enlightened view about hitting people. And I'm glad that we don't actually do that. But what is that? It's a measure of the seriousness of a problem, and it's a way to really get someone's attention. And to me, it's interesting that people would somehow accept such punishment. And they thought, oh my God, the abbot just hit me. I think I better do something, you know, that would have that kind of effect. To some extent also, I'm presuming, I don't know for sure, but it could be that Benedict is sort of overdoing his point and saying, we hope it doesn't come to the blows. In any case, it's written, the fool cannot be corrected with words. And again, strike your son with a rod and you will free his soul from death. Again, Benedict's habit of the biblical warrant. This next paragraph is full of wise advice. The abbot must always remember what he is and remember what he is called. Aware that more will be expected of a man to whom more has been entrusted. He must know what a difficult and demanding burden he has undertaken. You could say that the abbot is meant to be like Christ in this, in that the Christ himself came not to be served, but to serve. And he is the community's model. The abbot must be the community's model, really, of service and of meekness and of humility. The burden that the abbot has undertaken is directing souls and serving a variety of temperaments. And there are the words again, coaxing, reproving, and encouraging them as appropriate. See how all around so many different kinds of reactions are needed in the monastery, because there are so many different kinds of monks in the monastery. He must so accommodate and adapt himself to each one's character and intelligence. Those are both great words, aren't they, huh? Accommodate and adapt to each one's character and intelligence, that he will not only keep the flock entrusted to his care from dwindling, but will rejoice in the increase of a good flock. And that's something that we pray for here in the monastery, and it's something that at present this is happening. God is bringing a little bit more than he has brought in the last years to the monastery now. And you're meeting some of these younger monks some are at lunch, and some will be at dinner, and some will be at lunch tomorrow. That's my flock that's growing. Mm-hmm. And I have to be thinking of them all the time. Mm-hmm. And it's something beautiful and wonderful. I can share with you an experience I had just shortly after I was elected. I was elected just 2 or 3 weeks before Easter, and when the abbot's elected, he immediately is the abbot. You start right then and there. Mm-hmm. And the abbot presides at all the Holy Week and Easter liturgies, and I was happy to do that. That's one of the things that's up my alley, one of the few things that's up my alley as we be an abbot. I love to celebrate the liturgy. I love to preach. But I was listening to the Passion on Good Friday, which is part of the liturgy, the Passion according to John. And I was pretty deep inside it and identifying with the scene of Jesus' death and the service of his death, and somehow taking that as a model for myself as abbot. And we came to that scene that's only in John's gospel, where just before he dies, Jesus turning and seeing his mother and the disciple whom he loved, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." And to his beloved disciple, he said, "Behold your mother." And I felt the standard interpretation, and I'm sure it's the correct interpretation, that is that exchange of Jesus and his relationship with his mother is really given to every Christian. What Jesus was doing as part of his passion there was asking of his mother an amazing kind of sacrifice, to take somebody else in exchange for him. That's the deep mystery. That's Mary's passion, huh? To take someone else in exchange for him, and asking of his disciple to receive the gift of his own mother as a mother for him. Okay, that's not my bright idea. That's the way the church has interpreted that passage through the centuries. But as abbot, I was receiving that in a new and more intense way. And then I experienced that it was also given to all of the monks at Mount Angel as it was given to me. So basically, what was happening in the community's celebration of the liturgy that year was Jesus turns to his mother and says, "Woman, behold your sons, this monastic community." And he says to the monastic community, "Sons, behold your mother." And that was a tremendous grace for me, which I shared with the community in one of my Friday morning chapter conferences, and asked them to remember it every time that we, at Compline every night, when we walk to the Blessed Virgin statue. I told the monks that I'm praying that, and they can remember it too. I'll need to remind them again, argument, reproof, and repeal. But that's for me been a beautiful time of prayer, is that every evening as I lead the monastic community before the Virgin's altar to sing the Salve Regina, I'm saying in my heart, "Woman, behold your sons." And then as we're arriving, I'm watching the monks arrive, and I'm saying it in my heart, "Sons, behold your mother." That's the kind of flock I ask you to pray with me, that we can rejoice in its increase. Verse 33 is extremely important and puts things in balance. "Above all, the abbot must not show too great concern for the fleeting and temporal things of the world, neglecting or treating lightly the welfare of those entrusted to him." That's easily said, but I think one of the most challenging experiences I have as abbot of this big monastery and seminary is, just put it in a sort of desperate panic mode, I have to run this place. And it costs a lot of money. And there's a lot of problems, and the roof blows off and things like that. And you have to worry about that. Above all, he must not show too great concern for the fleeting and temporal things of this world. And so what do? Because you have to take care of the place. And Benedict has other chapters about how other monks are to help him with that. And in this complicated world in which we live, my predecessor, Abbot Nathan, set up very competent boards of people who know how to take care of the temporal things of this world. And the Abbey receives tremendous help from friends in terms of guidance and advice. But that's ultimately also the abbot's concern. And so as I met with them for the first time, I actually read this part of the rule to them, as they asked me the question, "How can we help you?" And I'll tell you, you can help me to not show too great concern, so that I can do what instead? Verse 34. "Rather, he should keep in mind that he has undertaken the care of souls for whom he must give an account." And so that's where the abbot's energies have to be able to be concentrated. And that takes, I'm finding, a lot of complicated organization that I'm still just new at, getting it, making it possible for me to concentrate my energies in the care of the souls or of the flocks entrusted to my care. "That he may not plead lack of resources as an excuse." See how he knows human character, huh? "I can't do this." You know, that's pleading lack of resources, yeah? "He is to remember what is written." And again, the scriptures are making this school of the Lord's service very practically. "Seek the kingdom of God and his justice, and all these things will be given you as well. And again, those who fear the Lord lack nothing. Very wise advice. Verse 37. The abbot must know that anyone undertaking the charge of souls must be ready to account for them. Whatever the number of the brothers he has in his care, let him realize that on judgment day, he will surely have to submit a reckoning to the Lord for all their souls, and indeed for his own as well. In this way, while always fearful of the future examination of the shepherd about the sheep entrusted to him, and careful about the state of others' accounts, he becomes concerned also about his own. And while helping others to amend by his warnings, he achieves the amendment of his own faults. So, in the end, maybe a shorter way of putting that is the abbot's way to heaven is by helping the other monks to heaven. The abbot would become holy if he were doing what an abbot is meant to do. So, pray for me. What can I say? That's the game. That's what we're trying to do. If this were just thematic study of the rule and we had lots of time, we could say a lot more about the abbot by going to chapter 64. Keep a finger there and turn to chapter 64. I just want you to see visually on the page that we got another whole chapter here about abbot. And it's just as good as this one. Full of wise advice. It says on the election of the abbot, but it's about the criteria that you would use to know how to go about electing. We may get to that later, but as I said, it's sort of difficult for me to talk about abbot now that I am abbot. So I want to go on to some other stuff in the rule, but I want you to know that chapter 64 is there. And for those of you that are spending time reading the rule outside the conferences, that would be a good chapter to read, and that too will help you to pray for me and feel sorry for me as well. So chapter 3, the next chapter, is a shorter chapter, but it's, to me, it's one of the most beautiful chapters of the rule for its practical advice and also for some of the innovations that it makes within the monastic tradition of his time. Remember last night I said that Saint Benedict is making choices in the midst of an already well-established tradition. And here, with the idea of summoning the brothers together for counsel, Benedict is a real innovator and doing something that in monastic life had not been done to this extent before. In other monastic traditions, everything was in the hands of the abbot. And now here, after having just finished, he's obviously put a lot in the hands of the abbot, but now having finished that, he goes on to talk about another thing that the abbot should do. And I think that in this particular chapter, you will see really sensible advice, but you will also see the kind of balance that Benedict brings to the life. And this is why among all of the ancient rules from the ancient world, in fact, Benedict's rule is the one that's kind of the cream coming to the top, and it's survived all these centuries. It has to be because it's so balanced and sensible. As often as anything is important to be done in the monastery, the abbot shall call the whole community together and himself explain what the business is. Okay, so the abbot's still leading. He calls the whole community together. This isn't to say, hey, what do you guys want to talk about? He decides to call the community together because there's something important and he wants to hear from the whole community. And after hearing the advice of the brothers, let him ponder it and follow what he judges the wiser course. So this is not the community getting together to vote on what we're going to do. the abbot's going to decide what we're going to do. But Benedict is urging that we hear everybody and that the abbot decide. The reason why we have said that all should be called for counsel is that the Lord often reveals what is better to the younger. This is beautiful, huh? And really unusual in the ancient world. In the ancient world, age and seniority was a trump card for everything. And so that Benedict is saying to listen to the younger is something quite striking. It also, we could say that in listening to the younger, you're listening to the weaker members of the community. And you're listening to those then who might, in fact, just by the nature of their circumstances, be the more vulnerable among the community. So it's a small little sentence. And if we're sort of used to listening to everybody. But in Benedict's time, this was quite striking. A similar chapter does not exist in Benedict's text, The Rule of the Master. And this emphasis on listening to the young is very rare in monastic life. So this is one of the ways that we're seeing Benedict as an innovator. The next verse is also very well done. The brothers, for their part, are to express their opinions with all humility and not presume to defend their own views obstinately. So this isn't a meeting like that we tend to have meetings in our day. I'm going to go to the meeting and win. You don't do it that way in a monastery. But we come from this culture of ours. We're American monks. And Americans go to meetings and win. And it doesn't work in the monastery, or it ought not to happen. And so the abbot has to run such a meeting in such a way that kind of an attitude is not coming forward. What are we doing here? We are looking for the will of the Holy Spirit. And the community has to be in the right mood for the Spirit to speak through the community. And it's not going to speak through the younger or the older if people are in there obstinately defending their own point of view. Okay? I think you might be amazed at how we have actually two kinds of meetings in the monastery. One where we have good old-fashioned American discussion and stuff. And then we have more formal meetings where we're making a formal decision. And the abbot explains the matter, and then I just go down in seniority, starting with the oldest, and ask each one what he'd like to say. And it's very edifying. This is before I was abbot, very edifying to see how a monk will speak just very simply and say what he thinks. No pushing, no shoving. Sometimes amazingly forceful things said quietly. There it is. You can think about it. It's beautiful. This could be a monastic contribution to culture in general. Huh? You can take, surely friends of monks can take some clues from this chapter about things that you're also responsible for and how to listen to opinions. So, no one presumes to defend their own views obstinately. The decision is rather the abbot's to make. Couldn't be clearer than that, huh? And so, since it's that clear, we've been talking and we will talk about obedience. Where does obedience happen? It happens in a context like this. The abbot will make a decision. He's heard you. He will make a decision. And the decision is the abbot's to make, so that when he has determined what is more prudent, all may obey. Nevertheless, just as it is proper for the disciples to obey their master, so it is becoming for the master, on his part, to settle everything with foresight and fairness. So if the community is not feeling foresight and fairness from the abbot, it's going to be harder for them to obey. So the community has what they have to be obedient to, and the abbot has what he has to be obedient to. Accordingly, it's still a, I don't know if you like this chapter as much as I do. I just find it sweet and sensible. Yeah? It's still going on that way. Accordingly, in every instance, all are to follow the teaching of the rule, and no one shall rashly deviate from it. So, what's a Cenobite? He follows a rule and an abbot. And the abbot also follows the rule. And people have opinions. How do you shape your opinions? According to the rule. It would be a crazy thing for a monk to say at a chapter meeting, I think we need to do away with such and such a chapter of the rule. No, the rule is where our opinions come from. In the monastery, no one is to follow his own heart's desire, nor shall anyone presume to contend with his abbot defiantly or outside the monastery. You can see how quickly things could break down if that were to happen. And, you know, if Benedict is legislating against things like this, it isn't because he's got a wild imagination. It's because these things happened. And they still would happen. And people actually accidentally do it and don't know it. A monk can come out of a meeting with an abbot and just be frustrated and run into a friend at the guest house and start doing it. Watch out, says St. Benedict. Because that's going to create a kind of scandal that the monk isn't aware of. He's just blowing off steam. Or maybe it's worse than that. Maybe he's using the monks against the abbot, or maybe he's using his guests against the abbot. No one is to do that, says St. Benedict. The abbot heard you, and he took the responsibility to make a decision. No one is to fight that. That's obedience. This is a school of the Lord's service. Should anyone presume to do so, let him be subjected to the discipline of the rule. You may wonder what that means. Those are the chapters we're not going to read. But Benedict has in beginning at chapter around 21 or 22, he begins talking about different ways in which various penalties are applied within the monastery. Too complicated to go into and may leave the wrong impression, but there is a part of that of the rule. Anyhow, verse 11, moreover, the abbot himself must fear God and keep the rule in everything he does. He can be sure beyond any doubt that he will have to give an account of all his judgments to God, the most just of judges. If less important business of the monastery is to be transacted, he shall take counsel with the seniors only. As it is written, see his habit again. I'm going to draw your attention to it every time. Everything we do here has its scriptural warrant. As it is written, do everything with counsel, and you will not be sorry afterward. And that taking counsel with the seniors only is structured into our way of life. There's a body in the monastery called the council. And the council is formed of six monks and the abbot. The abbot appoints the helper, the prior and the sub-prior, and then three other monks are elected by the whole community brought together to advise the abbot. So the community has its own advisors of the abbot, and then the abbot appoints one other person. So both of these provisions of chapter 3 are very much in place here, and I use them all the time. And my predecessors have used them all the time. Okay, so that's that chapter. Chapter 4 is called The Tools of Good Works. And in the preface of the book that I was reading at table today by Michael Casey, he referred to this chapter as the chapter that has 73 different instruments or tools that a monk should have in his toolkit. translated tools or instruments. The Latin is instrumentum. And we're not gonna read this chapter together because it's difficult to comment on verbally. It's a list of a whole bunch of good advice, but what's striking, I'll just point out a few characteristics of it to you, but it's certainly a chapter that, you know, you get to keep your copy of the rule and take it home. This is a chapter to read later and read one or two instruments a day as a kind of an examination of conscience and see if you're doing that. But what's interesting to me, and I remember when it first started, I thought, well, okay, let's get down to business here and get into the monastic stuff, the tools that will make you a monk. Well, okay, first of all, love the Lord your God with your whole heart, your whole soul, and your whole strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. The monastic life, in that sense, it's the Christian life. That's the command to all of us. And that's where you start. There's nothing esoteric about Benedict's monasticism. It's not a special secret Christian way to God. You begin with these basic commandments. And then the following: you are not to kill. I remember thinking, gosh, who are we talking to here? Isn't it these monks? But after I lived here a while, I realized this. You just got to repeat these things, you know. Anyway, and so on. But then, beginning at verse 10, it gets into things that would be more specifically monastic emphasis. Renounce yourself in order to follow Christ. Or at verse 20, which is the title of the book we're reading, your way of acting should be different from the world's way. And anyway, I just recommend that list to you. I say that we don't have time to go over it because it's just piling up. It is a beautiful and interesting and helpful catalog of monastic practices, all of them deeply rooted in the scriptures again. So what kind of a school do we have in the monastery? It is, I repeat, a program for living the scriptures. You're gonna do the scriptures. The last one at verse 74 is a beautiful one, and I've found so important in the monastic life for myself and for many others whom I've encouraged through different circumstances through the year, and that I will certainly find occasion to remind people of as abbot. Finally, never lose hope in God's mercy. And we tend to do that. I think, I can't be helped, or that person can't be helped. Never lose hope in God's mercy. Michael Casey said in the preface today, you need all these instruments, and as you become a good monk, you need to know, you reach in the toolkit and pull out the one you need here and now. And you're going to need this big tool. Never lose hope in God's mercy. The end of that is nice at 75. We can read that. These then are the tools of the spiritual craft. Nice word. This is an art. The monastic life is a craft. It's an art. The Latin word is art. And when we have used them without ceasing day and night and have returned them on judgment day, our wages will be the reward the Lord has promised. What the eye has not seen, nor the ear heard, God has prepared for those who love him. And what is that? It's the Lord himself. And the workshop where we are to toil faithfully at all these tasks is the enclosure of the monastery and stability in the community. Stability in the community means, for Saint Benedict, promising, it's actually one of the vows that Benedictine monks make, the promise to stay in this community and to stay in this way of life. And the reason why we make a vow of that is because, as we saw from the prologue last night, there will be a tendency to flee when it gets hard. And he says, don't be afraid if it's difficult at first. The beginning must be. So you hold to the stability and you do it inside the monastery. Now we come to an important chapter and one that I am going to spend time commenting on. And one that gives a huge insight into monastic life, the chapter on obedience. We saw from the first lines of the prologue that obedience is a characteristic pattern of the monastic life. Yeah, obedience in imitation of Christ, who himself was obedient. And so that in order for me to imitate Christ, I'm going to come to the monastery and enter a regime of obedience, so that I can do, as Christ did, the will of another. That's why there is this setup of the pattern of obedience. And we won't understand it if we just think, gosh, that's a hard life. You know, that somebody gets to be in charge and boss you around. That's not the attitude for understanding what's happening. Obedience will free the monk. It's a freedom, and it's what you're doing with your freedom. It's your gift to God is to enter into this relationship of obedience with the community's ways and into obedience with the abbot. This chapter presumes an abbot like we just read about in chapter 2. And if you have an abbot that is even remotely like that, then obedience becomes possible and something joyful to do. The first step of humility is unhesitating obedience, which comes naturally to those who cherish Christ above all. Okay? This is about love. It's about loving Christ. And if that's not a component, it makes no sense. There would be no reason to do that. And this is connected with the first line of chapter 2 that we saw about the abbot. The abbot is believed to hold the place of Christ in the community. So the abbot asks me something, and unhesitatingly, I do it because I cherish Christ above all. This is a program. This is the school in which I can express that I cherish Christ. Because of the holy service they have professed, this is a school of the Lord's service. So we have professed that we're in this school. So that's why we're doing it. You should hear that echo from the prologue. This is a school of the Lord's service. Okay, you said you want to be in this school. Because of the holy service they have professed, or because of dread of hell and for the glory of everlasting life, they carry out the superior's order as promptly as if the command came from God himself. We had in the first line the word unhesitating. We have in this line promptly. There's a spirit moving here. And how dare he say, as promptly as if the command came from God himself? He dare because the abbot is believed to hold the place of Christ in the community. And that's why you would be prompt. In my case, in anybody's case, it's not, oh, I like Abbot Jeremy. I think I'll obey him. I don't like him. I don't think I will. It doesn't work that way. It's not about us liking one another. It's about how the Lord works through these weak instruments in the community. It's hard to keep track of all this when you're doing it, you know? So this is the craft of monastic life, is keeping track of it. And the tools will help all this to happen. The Lord says of men like these, no sooner did he hear than he obeyed me. So there is the scriptural warrant again of why anyone would move quickly on a command. And the Lord is saying, you obeyed me when you obeyed in the community. And again, he tells teachers, whoever listens to you listens to me. Jesus said that to his apostles as he sent them out teaching. So this isn't sort of like Benedict says, hey, I'm not making this up. This is Jesus' idea. Okay? Jesus has arrangements like this. It's the relationship of obeying another. Such people as these immediately put aside their own concerns. There's another word. We had unhesitating, we had promptly, now we have immediately. Immediately put aside their own concerns. In Matthew 4:22, that word immediately, they dropped their nets and followed him. Immediately is a good scriptural word. And in this school, we do it immediately because we want to be like those apostles who immediately followed. Such people as these immediately put aside their own concerns, abandon their own will, and lay down whatever they have in hand, leaving it unfinished. I would say that's poetic exaggeration, but it's a bit of a flair here. But this leaving aside your own will is the point. And you can be asked in the monastery, and it happens often, either by circumstances or by direct command, to do something that's going to interrupt you and that the circumstances require. Charity requires it. Amendment of faults requires it. The arrival of a guest requires it. To all these things, we're being obedient. Quickly move. That's a monk. If you quickly move, you don't go, oh, okay. That's not a monk. You go right away. With the ready step of obedience. Look at the different language with which he's piling up there. Get on it, go. And that's because this is a school. With the ready step of obedience, they follow the voice of authority in their actions. Almost at the same moment then as the master gives the instruction, the disciple quickly, there's another word in that same category, quickly puts it into practice in the fear of God, and both actions together are swiftly completed as one. A whole bunch of words there. Quickly, swiftly, promptly, immediately, unhesitatingly. That's obedience. That's a school. That's becoming like Christ. Why do all this? Verse 10. It is love. That's the reason, huh? If you don't do this for that reason, never mind. This is not military obedience. You know, you do need obedience in the military, you know. Nobody questions anything in the military, otherwise the group won't go out and shoot the people or something. That's a different kind of obedience. This isn't what that's about. This is for love. And if it's not love, then it's no good. And it's love that impels them to pursue everlasting life. He's saying nothing less than our salvation is at stake in what we're doing here. We're pursuing everlasting life by doing this pattern of obedience. Therefore, they are eager to take the narrow road of which the Lord says narrow is the road that leads to life. So, Benedict does not presume, and no one presumes here, that obedience is easy. This is a narrow road, but it is a road that leads to life. Christ's example, more than anything, Christ in his own obedience to the Father, is the narrowest road. The narrowest road led Jesus to the cross. And for love of him, I will imitate him in taking that narrow road. They no longer live by their own judgment, giving in to their whims and appetites. Rather, they walk according to another's decisions and directions, choosing to live in monasteries and to have an abbot over them. Cenobites. He's going back to that definition of Cenobites. It's a choice, and you live by another's decisions. Like Jesus, not my will, Father, but thine be done. I'd like to live that way. Okay, live under a rule and an abbot, and all day long you'll be saying, like Jesus said, not my will, but yours be done. What's that do? It frees you. It leads you to everlasting life. It assures you of doing God's will with what you do in the course of your day. Men of this resolve unquestionably conform to the saying of the Lord, I have come not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. That's what I've been saying. This conforms you to Christ, who said that. I have come not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. The next paragraph speaks of the interior attitude of obedience. We could say, so far we have spoken in general terms of the exterior attitude of obedience, emphasizing the swiftness with which it's to be done. But here's the attitude now with which obedience is to be done. This very obedience, however, will be acceptable to God and agreeable to men only if compliance with what is commanded is not cringing or sluggish or half-hearted, but free from any grumbling or any reaction of unwillingness. Okay, that's, in a sense, that needs to be said, because it isn't obedience, at least in a monastic way, if you just do what you were told and you're kind of sore about it. And you let the one who had the burden of asking you to be obedient, you let him feel it. That's not obedience. The abbot should be able to feel from a monk that he has to ask something. He should be able, especially if he's asking something difficult, he should not be made to feel bad for asking that. Huh? That's not obedience. You're not going to find any monks that flat out disobey you, I don't think. But it is possible to find this attitude just a little bit, you know, hidden. But it just squeaks out the side of monks, you know. And they can't help it. So that's why Benedict is talking about it, you know. So he wants us to learn. He wants all the monks to learn not to be obedient in that half-hearted way. For the obedience shown to superiors is given to God. Why? Because the abbot is believed to hold the place of Christ. And we'll see there's another chapter in which the abbot is not the only person that a monk is obedient to. There's another chapter that I hope we get to sometime tomorrow called Mutual Obedience. And that's a way in which we need to just yield to one another. That too is obedience. And all of that is, in this school, is an obedience given to God. For as he himself said, whoever listens to you listens to me. That's the second time in this short chapter that Benedict has cited Luke 10:16. We saw it already. I drew your attention to it at verse 6. There it is again at this verse. So it's obviously something that Benedict insists on, and it's very simple to understand. This is because the superior is God's, is believed to hold the place of Christ. Furthermore, the disciples' obedience must be given gladly, for God loves a cheerful giver. Again, the biblical warrant for the attitudes that he's speaking about here. If a disciple obeys grudgingly and grumbles, not only aloud, but also in his heart, then even though he carries out the order, his actions will not be accepted with favor by God. So, you know, Benedict is on to human nature. That's one of the things that's useful about him. The disciple obeys grudgingly and grumbles. Maybe you can't even see it. Maybe the monk has a brave smile on his face, but what his heart is doing is he's really mad. Benedict's talking to all the monks here. He's not talking to the abbot anymore. He's talking to all the monks. You can't have that in your heart. This is not, Christ was not that way. And we're imitating him. So, verse 19, he will have no reward for service of this kind. On the contrary, he will incur punishment for grumbling unless he changes for the better and makes amends. Okay, well, that's the chapter on obedience, and it lays down the principles. Throughout the rest of the rule, there are many occasions where Benedict is requiring obedience and explaining this specific thing, the abbot decides this or somebody else decides that, and obedience is what's required. So you may remember last night I said the prologue and chapters 1 through 7 laid down the theoretical principles of the monastic life, and then the rest of the rule spreads it out and unfolds it in specific circumstances. So what we've said here in the chapter on obedience, that spreads itself out through the rest of the rule. In the same way that the chapter that we read on the abbot spreads itself out through the rest of the rule. And in the same way that summoning the brethren together for counsel, that will happen throughout the whole rest of the rule. We'll see it in specific moments where that's coming to the fore. Okay, let's go on to chapter 6, which is restraint of speech. And that's, I'll let you read that on your own. It doesn't need too much commentary. I note for you just that it's there in the same opening part and of the rule that is laying down principles. So restraint in speech, in fact, is going to be spread throughout the rule as well. This is about not saying too much, and it's also about being quiet. Later in the rule, Benedict will say when you can talk, when you for sure need to be silent. So, but what the program is here is about being a disciple. It's a short chapter, which is perhaps a symbol in its own right. It would be kind of odd to say too much about not saying too much, okay? So. But the next chapter on humility, you can turn some pages and see that it's a very long chapter. And this is considered one of the most important chapters of the Holy Rule. It goes on and on. I think it's the longest chapter of the Rule. And it's about humility, and ultimately Benedict develops 12 steps of humility. Now you could say that this is a fundamental chapter of the rule, and we can learn a great deal about humility from this in the Christian tradition. And actually, it's such a long chapter that I'm not going to comment on it at length or on all 12 steps of humility. But I want to at least acquaint you with the structure of the chapter and pause on a couple of the steps of humility that are there. I would like to, we could have a whole fellowship retreat on 4 of the 12 steps, and then the next year do 4 more. But this is a real key to the monastic life. And we simply haven't time to go into that and do other parts of the rule as well. But by skipping over it, I don't want to skip over it as if it's not important. This is the linchpin, in a sense, of the rule. Let's see how Benedict begins it before he gets down to enumerating the steps. He says, brothers, divine scripture calls to us, saying, whoever exalts himself shall be humbled, and whoever humbles himself shall be exalted. So again, the scriptural warrant for what he's talking about, this basic pattern of Jesus' teaching, and this is going to be the pattern that Benedict unfolds for us. In saying this, therefore, it shows us that every exaltation is a kind of pride, which the prophet indicates he has shunned, saying, O Lord, my heart is not exalted, my eyes are not lifted up, and I have not walked in the ways of the great, nor gone after marvels beyond me. You've heard that one before, haven't you? We say it, that's a psalm. But can you live that? Can you say that about your life? My heart is not exalted. My eyes are not lifted up, and I have not walked in the ways of the great, nor gone beyond marvels beyond me. Come to this school. I'll teach you to say that. Okay? How? If I had not a humble spirit, what were exalted instead, then you would treat me like a weaned child on its mother's lap. Accordingly, brothers, if we want to reach the highest summit of humility, look here, Benedict begins to play with up and down, okay? Because exaltation is up and humility is down. But now he says, if we want to reach the highest summit of humility, if we desire to attain speedily that exaltation in heaven, so exaltation, summit, to which we climb up by the humility of this present life, he's joking around with up and down words, huh? You just have to get the joke, okay? Then by our ascending actions, we must set up a ladder on which Jacob, in a dream, saw angels descending and ascending. Scriptural warrant again, big scriptural image, and he's put before our eyes this scene from the scriptures of this vision that Jacob had at night, a ladder that goes up to heaven, and angels going up and down on it. Why? What's it going to do with that? He's got up and down in place, and he's got a biblical warrant for it. So we're going to do the Bible here, and then watch what he does. Without doubt, this descent and ascent, the angels going up and down, can signify only that we descend by exaltation and ascend by humility. So, boom, the whole tables are turned, okay? He's playing around. He's got a game here, okay? Now, the ladder erected is our life on earth. And if we humble our hearts, the Lord will raise it to heaven. We may call our body and soul the sides of this ladder, into which our divine vocation has fitted the various steps of humility and discipline as we ascend. So we're going up a ladder by going down. And that was the mysterious vision that Jacob had. In the stairwell on this side of the building, you have a tapestry of Jacob's vision. And that's there to remind us of this chapter on humility. Check out the details of that. So we've got the sides of the ladder are our body and soul. There are 12 steps of the ladder that bring us to the summit of humility, which you get to by going down. Okay? And so he outlines the steps. The first one, the first step of humility then, is that a man keep the fear of God always before his eyes and never forget it. And then there's a long development on what fear of the Lord means, very biblically constructed. And that's the longest development, and then other shorter steps that follow. We're out of time for this conference now. Tonight we'll dip into one or two of these steps that I want to draw your attention to, and then we will move to other parts of the rule. because part of our exercise is to get you into some of the specific legislation and see how the wisdom of Benedict will come out then in very practical detailing and arrangements. Okay, so thank you and God bless you. The next thing on the schedule, it's not too long from now, is Vespers at 5:15. And be back over here by 6 when we shall start reading and eating together. Okay? Thank you. Thank you.